experience drinking. Tonight, I would like to introduce our speaker, Jay. Jay, it's all yours. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jill. Jay, grateful, compulsive eater. Grateful I'm alive. Excuse me. Grateful I woke up today. Grateful I'm here. I'm especially grateful that God has chosen to keep me alive long enough to start getting some of the many benefits and miracles and of recovery and promises that are promised to us after the ninth step on pages 83 and 84 of the big book. It's funny, when Joe asked me to speak, and I said, well, how long would I be speaking? He said, 45 to 50 minutes. And I just burst out laughing. I said, Joe, I got ADHD. I have a problem keeping my attention to myself for 10 minutes. However, I am going to share my story and my experience, strength, and hope. And however long it lasts the rest of the time, could be questions or whatever. Otherwise, I may have to start a new 12-step group called On and On and On. In any case, Jay, grateful compulsive eater. First memory of compulsive eating, 4 years old. Ovaltine was my crack cocaine. I found out it's still sold in the United States. My God, I was 4 years old in 1953. 74 years old now, but yeah, that was my crack cocaine. At the time, you were supposed to mix it with hot water first to make this like paste thing, and then add milk. Forget the milk, forget the hot water. I just ate it by the spoonful out of the jar. That was my first memory, and I had an experience that I want to share because I think it has something to do with my compulsive eating, although I'm not sure. That first memory of eating the Ovaltine was my parents, I thought, were asleep. Now, this is from a four-year-old's perspective. So it was probably, I don't know, 8:15 at night or 8:30 at night, something like that. You know, but, oh, I don't see my parents anywhere, so they're asleep. I got out of my bed, went into the kitchen. The Ovaltine was in this cabinet above the stove. I get a chair. I was an industrious young lad, folks. Pull it up to the stove, climb onto the chair so that I could climb onto the stove so I could open the cabinet to get my Ovaltine. I bring it down. I figured, I'll mix it with milk. Didn't want to do the hot water thing because that may wake my parents up. And then I drink it and I go, ugh. Turns out it wasn't hot chocolate. It was instant coffee. And I never tasted coffee before in my life. My father is disturbed by the, comes to the kitchen, starts yelling at me at the top of his lungs, I may tell more about that in my story, but the only consistent emotion that I ever saw in my parents was either anger or laughter. I never experienced love being demonstrated. I never experienced warmth being demonstrated. I never experienced understanding being demonstrated. Just yelling. So my father's yelling at me at the top of his lungs. And now they call it, I don't know, detachment, astral projection, whatever you want to call it. I literally remember 70 years later leaving my body while my father's yelling at me. Here's this huge, giant person yelling at me. I don't know how tall I was, but I was small. I remember leaving my body and waiting by the ceiling until he got done yelling at me. So I thought it'd be safe to return to my body. Gets done yelling at me. I return to my body. And in retrospect, that was the first time that I detached from me and my feelings when it came to food. And from that point on, the race was on, folks. The two highlights of my childhood, well, three highlights. Number one is when my mother would go shopping on Thursdays. In those days, the grocery store ads were put out on Thursdays. My mother would see the ads and go shopping on Thursdays. And then she'd come home, usually right after I got home from school. So 3:30, 4:15, whatever. And I would run out to the car and eagerly help her in with the groceries. Oh, Jay, you're such a good boy. Just, yeah, I wasn't doing it for her. I was looking to see what my bounty was going to be for the week. Okay. It was Thursdays. Second highlight was Saturdays, because Saturdays I would ride my bike to this mall and go to the candy section. And I wouldn't get candy, interestingly enough, to me anyway. I would get an eighth of a pound exactly of different kinds of nuts. And I would ride it home. That, 2 16-ounce bottles of soda, and watching baseball games, if it was baseball time or bowling or, I don't know, anything on television, that was my afternoon. Pretty much all throughout high school, if I didn't have anything to do on a Saturday, that's what I did. Okay. That was my childhood. During my childhood, from the age of about 8 until about, I would guesstimate, 7 or 8 until the age of about 12, I went through the motions of committing suicide, I would guess somewhere between 15 and 20 times. If this is graphic for anybody, I apologize. So I'm not going to get into the graphicness of it. But let's just say that I would go through the motions of committing suicide. And what I would do is I would do something that would stop, that if I would have completed it, it would have stopped my breath. And the reason was, it was interesting. I never thought about committing suicide. What I thought about was that I found that when I held my breath, I didn't feel anything. If I held my breath for more than 5-10 seconds, boom, feelings were gone. I was just holding my breath. So the thought from a little kid's perspective was, well, why not do that permanently? Okay, thank God I never was successful at it. And the reason was, these feelings that I had of sadness, of separateness, of, I'm not even going to say abandonment, because I never felt whatever is the opposite of abandonment. I never felt connected with my family. From a very early age, I remember feeling like I was an alien from another planet who had been dropped onto Earth and into this family. There is a video that I have. It was a 16-millimeter movie that got turned into a DVD by my brother. And it shows my family at a picnic in a park. It looks like I'm about maybe 5 years old. My sisters, I have twin sisters, they look like they're about 1. So I might have been 6, maybe. And my mother is smiling and my brother is looking for the camera. And you could see me just getting up and just walking away. Just walking out of the picture, okay? Nobody got up to get me at that. Now, maybe somebody did afterwards. I don't know. At one point, they probably would have said, where's Jay? But that was pretty emblematic for me of how I felt growing up in my nuclear family. What does this have to do with my compulsive eating? Drum roll here. Nothing. I'm an addict. I take responsibility for my addiction. I can blame it on my upbringing. But you know what? There are people that have a similar upbringing than me or worse, who don't compulsively eat, who don't do drugs, who don't drink alcohol. They deal with it in some other way. I didn't. Am I blaming myself? Not at all. I compulsively ate to survive the craziness in my household. When I described all of this to my Al-Anon sponsor, the first time we ever got together for coffee after he agreed to be my sponsor, and I got done, and he looked at me and said, Jay, do you realize that you were living in a war zone? He was in the Korean War. So when he said that, I took it to heart. And I said, no, I never looked at it that way. But I did. My house for me was growing up walking on eggshells to make sure I didn't screw up. I did not look forward to see what I wanted to do with my life, unless it was a fantasy thing. But I just wanted to make sure I didn't screw up. It's like if I would have died, they would have put on my tombstone, Jay, he was a good boy because he never made trouble. Okay? I was insulated with myself. I was praying until I was about 8, 9 years old. I had a higher power. But it was like at the age of 8 or 9 years old, I was like, well, this ain't doing me any good. So I stopped and I took a vacation from God. He was always there. She was always there. But I took a vacation from God for about 40 years, and I'll get into how I came back to my higher power. And during that time, I call myself an agnostic. Okay. So got out of high school, got into promiscuous sex, got into illegal drugs. I will do anything that I think, I'm sorry, let me change that. I don't do that anymore. I have done anything that I thought, whether it's conscious or subconsciously, to get away from Jay, to get away from my feelings, that I didn't think would kill me in the immediate future. Whether kill me much later, that was irrelevant, okay? In the immediate future, which is why, of all the drugs I did, and I did everything that I could imagine, except heroin. Because my image, and then I found out that you could snort heroin, so I might have done that. But at that time, I just had this image of people shooting heroin. I was always afraid of needles. That was the only thing that stopped me from trying heroin. It was offered to me one or two times, but anything else was fine. Anything to get away from Jay. In any case, went through high school and college, and just miserable, just. Continually, consistently anxious, eating. I usually just binged at night. I binged when I was alone. This, to me, the most important ingredient, no pun intended, of my disease is secrecy. I did it alone. I don't want you to know about it. I didn't even want God to know about it. I didn't even want me to know about it. I just wanted to do it. And that's what I did. And I had no idea that that was connected to my anxiety or depression or anything like that. In 1977, I checked myself into a psychiatric institution for 3 months. And I mean, I didn't think it was going to be 3 months, but it was. And not only was it the best decision of my life up until that point, first time I felt safe. And I know that because I didn't have a comparison before that. It's like I thought not feeling safe was normal. Okay? I never felt safe in my parents' house and didn't feel safe anywhere. I finally felt safe. And when I left there, I was really scared. Not about entering the world, but not having a safe place to go to. And now I can honestly say today that my home, in terms of physical spaces, is the safest place that I can be in, which is a miracle, And I'm safe with myself now, and I'll get into that hopefully. I'm confident enough in my social skills, because that's another thing that I didn't qualify. I've been in OA for 35 years and I've been abstinent for over 27 years. And one of the things that I've known along my journey, and I see it more and more and more, especially the last couple of years, is what I call incremental, consistent discernment. It's one of the greatest gifts I get. It's like, oh, this is the thing to do here. This is what to say here. These are the words to say here. This is how I act here. And how do I do that? I connect with the one I call the chief. I call my higher power the chief. Okay. If I'm about to say something to somebody now, and I think I might be in any way confrontive in any way to the person, I pray before him, please, God, give me loving, kind, gracious words to say. Amen. And every time I do that, it turns out fine. It turns out fine. I also find when I do that, it becomes a self-selective process. I could literally say, in terms of people that are in any way consistent in my life, they really seem to like me and show it, and I really like them and show it. What a concept. I never even, not only did I never think that was possible, it was never something that I aspired to, okay? I just wanted, you know, they say, in our way, there's this almost catchphrase. It came from the vanity, state for the sanity. The weight on my body was never a problem for me. It was the weight in my head. This is a visual, folks. I'm pointing to my head. It was the weight into my head, in my head. That was my biggest barrier, was the anxiety. It was everything else. So my goal, since I came to OA, I didn't come to lose weight. I didn't come to gain weight. I came to feel more calm. I came to feel more safe. I came to feel more peaceful within my body, my mind, my soul, my heart, and my life. Thank God I've achieved that with that, and hopefully I'll get into that. In any case, so fast forward, and I've been in and out of psychotherapy since I was 22, aside from the psychiatric institution. And each time, you know, it's interesting, seems I get better and better and better psychiatrists or psychologists or whoever I'm working with. In fact, I'm working with a clinical psychologist right now. We've been working together about 4 or 5 years. I was seeing her once every 2 weeks at first. Then after a while, it became once every 3 weeks. Now we're down to once every 6 weeks. And just this past week, she said, you know, Jay, I think it's time that we start wrapping this up. She said, I think you have the tools now to just go on. And I said, I agree. Because what God and I, and through all of you, have created, I literally have in my phone at least 30 people, just off the top of my head, that I can call up and say, hi, I just want to connect. How are you doing? Or I just wanted to connect. Or listen, I feel like crap. I just want to share that. Can you just listen? Very powerful, okay? Because what I used to do is call up people when I felt like crap and I wanted to just listen and say, hi, how are you doing? Just call to see how you're doing. Bullshit. That may be true. Then I did want to see it, but the main reason I was calling was to say how I was doing. And I say, can you just listen? Because I don't want feedback. I just want somebody to listen. That's the gift that I was given in that psychiatric hospital for the first time in my life. This clinical psychologist that I worked with, he just listened. And then when I was all done, he would say, would you like feedback? And that's what I do with people. And I have a lot of people in my life that I can do that with, thank God. But it's been created through this program. It's been created through working the steps and everything else. So let's get to, I'm a retread. I came into OA in 1988 as an interested observer. This is interesting for people that have a problem with food. I don't have a problem with food. I just like it a lot. That's what went on in this head. So I don't even want to say in and out of OA for 7 years because I was never really in. I just came to observe. I would share whatever, but I didn't have a sponsor. None of that was important to me. In 1995, I'm sitting on my bed in my bedroom. I'm watching mindless TV out of Saturday night. I'm eating what at that time, I am a cereal monogamous binger, or I have been. Okay, that's my phraseology. It's not copyrighted, so you can steal it. A serial monogamous binger, which means that I would hook on one thing and then I binge on that for a number of years. I binged on root beer for about 10 years. Then I binged on what was it? Dr. Pepper for 15 years. And I binged on ice cream for about 15 years, particular kind of ice cream, but that's besides the point. I'm sitting on my bed. It's Memorial Day weekend. That's Saturday night, 1995. I'm sitting on that bed. I look at the TV. I've got a bowl of my favorite ice cream in front of me. I estimate over a period of about 15 years at least, I average between 4 and 8 scoops of ice cream a night. I figure five, six nights a week, unless I was out to dinner and I had dessert at some restaurant or something. But that was a lot of my Saturday nights. And I'm sitting on the bed and I look at the bowl and look at TV and I thought maybe there's another way to live besides this. And maybe it has to do with this substance that I'm eating. And so I pick up the phone. I call up AA because I knew that they would know AA's, I'm sorry, OA's number, phone number. They did. I called OA. I got a call back. I was told when the next meetings were around me. The next day, I went to my first meeting as an admitted compulsive overeater, which is a whole, or even entertain the possibility, which is a whole different ballgame than an interested observer. The day after that, I went to a meeting where I met the woman who became my sponsor for 25 years. And that's something that I wanted to highlight tonight is about sponsorship and how I got a sponsor. This is not a prescription, but boy, it's worked for me. First sponsor I asked was a sponsor for 25 years. The only reason it didn't work anymore is that she moved out of town. We were both from Chicago. She moved to Louisville. I moved to Tampa. It just didn't work anymore. So latest sponsor I've had the last 2.5, 3 years, something like that. Okay. Two sponsors in 27 years that I've been abstinent. How did I do that? Was that magic? Was that happenstance? Well, part of it, but it's also by design. I believe in vetting sponsors. Not only do I believe in it, I've experienced the value of it. What do I mean by that? This is not at all to put down sponsor lists the meetings have. Who needs to sponsor? Who's an available sponsor? Let's match you up. For me, that's like calling 1-800-SPONSOR, just taking anybody who says that they're a sponsor. It's too intimate for me. And I vet sponsors both times the way that I do plumbers or doctors or lawyers or anybody. I do my research. Now, there aren't Google reviews on sponsors. So what do? If there's somebody who sounds like they not only do they have what I want, but they are talking the way I like, their tone of voice is the way I like, I ask them for their phone number. If I don't get their phone number, then they're obviously not the person for me. Okay. And then I call them and I say, yeah, I just want to connect. What I ask them is, listen, I'm just wondering, do you sponsor? Yes. How do you sponsor? I find out something about them. Okay. Is their style of sponsoring? Do I think that that'll work for me? Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it does. I call them 3 or 4 more times. And each time my main factor is, how do I feel while I'm talking with this person? Do I experience being heard? Do I experience that it's safe? Do I experience them not telling me what to do? Because to quote Dr. Bob, one of his most famous quotes, you can't tell an alcoholic anything. And for me, you can't tell me anything. Okay? And I've taken that in anyway. But my point is that I did that with both of them. I called them 3 or 4 times first to just see how I felt. I felt safe. I felt comfortable. And it seemed like they liked talking with me. What a concept. You know? And I like talking with them. So what did I do? I asked them to be my sponsor. They both said yes. And the results have been wonderful. Is this a prescription for anybody else? Nope. Not at all. Okay. When I'm in a meeting and they say, would all available sponsors raise their hand? I don't do it. I don't do it because I don't want anybody to choose me just because I'm a sponsor. It hasn't worked for me. The relationship hasn't worked. But if somebody does, and this happens once in a while, somebody is referred to me because they heard me in a meeting. There's a new guy that comes to the meeting called Jay. He's a sponsor. A guy, it just happened a couple weeks ago. And so what I said was, I tell you what, I want you to experience me. I want you to choose me because I sound like I have what you want. So here's some meetings I'm going to be at. Come to those meetings. Listen to me. If you still want me to be your sponsor, let me know. If not, that's okay. I hope you find somebody else. Anyway, that scenario works for me in terms of sponsorship. It's too intimate a relationship. And I hear these horror stories about, oh my God, this person wants me to call them at 6 o'clock in the morning and we'll talk 5 minutes every day, blah, 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 blah. Well, that may work for that sponsor. That may work for the person sponsees that stay with them. I know it doesn't work for me. And one of those things that I've learned in this program is I need to do what works for me. When I say, and this is, I'm going to finish what I'm going to say about sponsoring. When somebody calls me and they've heard me speak and they like what I say, and they say, yeah, I was wondering if you'd be my sponsor. I say, well, let me ask you something. What are you looking for in a sponsor? Because I want to see if I think I can deliver it. I had a guy once about a half a year ago call me and say, I need somebody to kick my butt. I said, could you be more specific? I need somebody that if I'm off track, if I'm whatever, they're going to get on me. I said, I apologize for interrupting. I'm not your guy. I'm not your guy. I don't kick my butt, let alone other people's butts. It doesn't work for me. The boot in the butt doesn't work for me. Kindness, understanding, love, availability, that works for me. Okay? So that's all I can do. I wish you well, but I'm not your guy. So I found out what they want. Did I tell them what I want? What do I want to sponsor? See, I'm very specific. Thank God. I've gotten very clear about this. And it's not even what I want. It's what I need. And I tell them, I don't say this is what I want in a sponsee. I say this is what I need to continue working with somebody as a sponsor. Just two things. Number one, you tell me the truth. And the moment you realize that you haven't told me the truth, but that the truth has changed, you call me and let me know. I don't want to find out after the fact. It doesn't work for me. If I found out, and that was sparked by a guy that I worked with for 4 months, and then he found out that he had been lying about his food the whole time we had been working together, and I found out because he tripped himself up, basically. He said two things that just didn't make sense, and then he said, well, I've been, you know, not telling the truth about my food the whole time. And I said, yeah, that doesn't work for me. So I say that up front. I say, you know. And I say, I don't care what the truth is. I binged, I ate a whole cow. I don't care. I'm not going to say you're fired, any BS like that. No. I'm going to say, what were you feeling when you were eating that? Or right before you were eating that? Let's talk about that. I'm not interested in the war stories or whatever, you know. Anyway, but that's one thing. Tell me the truth. As soon as you realize you haven't told me the truth, tell me that truth. Or the truth has changed. Tell me right away. You want to find out after the fact. Second thing is that you do what you say you're going to do. I don't have a script of what you're going to do, by the way, if you're my sponsor. I don't. Okay? I don't. You could tell me, on my food plan, I eat ground up doorknobs. Literally true. The only thing that I think I would say to you is, wow, that's fascinating. Would you happen to know the nutritional content of doorknobs? I don't know. I'm open to it. You know? I don't care. To me, it makes no difference. No sugar, no flour, no blah, 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 blah. I don't care. What I care is that whatever is, you're telling me the truth. We'll get into that as time goes on, if you're interested. We'll take a look at the foods you're eating, what's the nutritional value, if you want to, if you're interested. But otherwise, I don't care. It's your program. It's not mine. Okay? I had a friend who literally ate one meal a day. Literally true. She was healthy. She was active. She ate one huge meal for dinner a day. She usually had her dinner about 5:30 in the afternoon. Worked for her. Okay. Wasn't sick. Didn't have any, you know, I'm not inside her body. To me, this is not a one size fits all. Okay. And if I read again every literature on what Dr. Bob and or Bill Wilson would go into a patient's room in the hospital, in Towns Hospital, and talk to them, all they did was share their story. I never read anything that said, you're an alcoholic. Never. Ever. They never took the person's inventory. Just share their story. You know, I could go on and on about this. When I'm in a meeting and I hear people say, yeah, and, you know, generally we stay away from sugar and white flour, I think to myself, shut up. Shut up. Because if I'm a newcomer and I hear that, I'm going to run, especially this newcomer, because something I didn't tell you. My binge foods, my compulsive eating, what are my binge foods? It's one thing. Can't have anything ice cold. That's what it was. Bite the ice cream. If I have anything ice cold, it is the gateway to everything else. The story of how my sponsor and I found out is not important, but it is important that I called in my food every day for 6 months before we found out. And I called it in before it went into my mouth. And we had an agreement. I call it in before it goes into my mouth. And if it changes before it goes into my mouth, I call in whatever the change is before it goes into my mouth. If I tell you I'm going to have chicken and I get to the freezer and there's no chicken there, there's, I don't know, pork or whatever, I call that in. I don't just say, well, it's protein. Unless I've called in and said I'm going to have 6 ounces of protein. Then it's okay. I need to tell the truth. Okay. So there are people that call in their food at the end of the day. God bless them. For me, you kidding? You kidding? Call it at the end of the day after I've eaten it? I don't get the value of that. And I'll tell you something, folks. This is my empirical data. Nobody else's. Or maybe it is somebody else's. Like I say, I've been in OA for 35 years. I've never met anybody that called it their food at the end of the day after they've eaten it. And they stayed abstinent for an extended period of time. And I say an extended period of time is at least 5, 6, 7 years. Never. There may be people out there. You may be one of them. I've never met them. So my own experience is that if I call it at the end of the day, I'm turning my sponsor into a priest and I'm giving my confession. My sponsor, I don't think, usually did not go to seminary school. Okay? It's not his or her job. So that's what works for me. In any case, let's see. So let's bring it up to the present day. Came back to God in the late 90s, I believe it was, after I'd come back to OA for 2 or 3 years, I thought, well, why not try praying? I found out a number of things about praying. Number one, it works. And here's my definition of works. I don't use God as Santa Claus anymore. I don't, God, I want to, you know, I want a pony, I want to whatever. Okay. What is God for? Is to ask him to help me. God, show me what to do here. And every time I pray that, he does it. It's interesting. When I am challenged with anything, now my favorite prayer is, God, how do I take care of myself right now in this moment? Not while I'm done, not when I'm done talking, not when the meeting's over, right now. Every time I pray that, it's a little bit different. Sometimes it's get a drink of water, sometimes take a walk. Sometimes it's just, I pray that prayer and my whole body calms down. So it's a little different each time. But you know what? The answer has never been go to the refrigerator and see what's inside. I'm open to it because I want to be God's will. It's never been there. And I've been doing that about 3 years. which says to me two things. That specific prayer I've been praying for 3 years, which says to me two things. Number one, it's God's ball game and not mine. And number two, my higher power knows a lot better than I do about what it takes to take care of myself besides me. When I have a sponsee ask me for a suggestion, ask me for advice, say, what should I do here? I have one of two or three responses. One thing I might say is, I have no idea, I'm not you, which is the truth. I'm not you. No idea what you should do. I'm working on what I should do. Okay? I'm not you. Then I say, have you asked your higher power? What I'm about to say is literally true. Of all the times a sponsee has asked me for advice, for a suggestion, and I say, have you asked your higher power? They say no. And I say, may I share with you my experience? Yes. My experience is that my higher power knows a lot better than I do about what it takes for me to take care of myself than anybody else I'm going to talk to on this planet, including me. Okay. So that's who I go to. That's all I do. I don't give advice. I don't give directives. I just share my experience, strength, and hope. If a sponsee says, well, I want your experience with this, I always give it with a caveat. If I do have an experience related to what they're saying, which is most of the time, I say yes. But here's the caveat. The caveat is that none of this is a prescription for you. This is what has worked for me. I'm only going to share with you if you ask me what has worked for me. I have no idea whether it's going to work for you. It's a journey because part of my addict, I want you to give me the rules. I never wanted the 12 steps, folks. I wanted the 12 rules. Tell me what to do. I'll do it in life. Like, fine. The challenge with that is that if the rules don't work, guess who I get to blame? You. Thanks. Take responsibility for myself. Well, then I'm going to wind it down, Joe. Thank you so much. So in conclusion, I want to say that I'm happier than I've ever been in my life, by far. And I'm happier much more than I'm not happy. And I never cared about being happy. I cared about being more peaceful, calm, and serene. And you and this program of higher power giving that to me. So thank you. My ADHD was held at bay, and I was able to talk this long. Praise God.